This feature of the Science News Radio Network is coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas. Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
And it's so good to have you back again as we explore the exciting world of the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation, big nanotechnology story here in our lead story today. And remind those of you listening on radio, you can also hear us commercial-free online webcast at promiseoftomorrow.biz. This is a Women in Science Month, and at the PITCON conference is going to be this brilliant chemist from the University of Minnesota, Christy Haynes, very well known. Christy is going to talk about the sears in blood and vibrational spectroscopy, fascinating stuff, curing of illnesses and diseases and other things like that with nanotechnology, and also some serious work with law enforcement. She's going to explain it all to us here in just a little bit. Anyway, she's speaking at PITCON. And, of course, PITCON, you can learn more about that at their website, PITTCON.org. And it's always exciting. PITCON is coming around again. It's going to be March 2 through 6 at McCormick Place in Chicago. It's a must-go for people that are in the science industry, especially if you care about nanotechnology. You know, at one time, PITCON's roots were in analytical chemistry and spectroscopy, but they've evolved into a conference and expo that now also serves a diverse constituency that brings in life sciences, pharmaceuticals, discoveries, and all sorts of different things. Food safety, environment, bioterrorism markets, many, many different things. So be sure and go and enjoy PITCON. You will love every minute of it. And of course, we're going to visit the Den of Strangers, get more wisdom from somebody a lot of us never heard of, visit our Fountain of Useless Information, and of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. But right now, let's get on the phone. You're listening to the Science News Radio Network. I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason. Let's get right to the phone and today's guest. Okay, so February is National Women in Science Month. And more women are getting into science all the time, which is our good luck. And one outstanding woman in science is Christy Haynes. She's with the University of Minnesota, and her specialty is bioanalytical. She is going to be giving a presentation at PITCON this March on SERS in blood, sears in blood, and vibrational spectroscopy. It kind of has me in the dark a little bit, but she's so brilliant, she's going to give us a great explanation. So welcome to the program, Christy.
Thank you very much.
Now, you're speaking, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, am I right in this, SERS in blood, is that pronounced SERS in blood?
SERS in blood is usually how people read that acronym. Surface Enhanced Raman Scattering is what that stands for. So it's a specialized kind of vibrational spectroscopy that I'm happy to explain if you're interested.
Oh, yeah, please do.
Okay. So Surface Enhanced Raman Scattering. Raman scattering is something that's been around for a long time. It was discovered in the early 1900s. A pretty simple idea that you can shine a certain wavelength of light onto a molecule and cause the molecule to vibrate. And most of the time, what happens is the photons that are released from the molecule when it's vibrating are the same exact frequency as the ones you shined on the molecule. But in a very small number of cases, something like 1 in 100 million cases, instead, the photon that comes out of the molecule is a slightly different frequency. And that difference in frequency is really important because it actually gives you very detailed information about what types of atoms and what arrangements of atoms are in the molecule. So I mentioned that this is a really infrequent process, that you get this inelastic light scattering or Raman scattering. And so this SE on the front of the SERS acronym stands for Surface Enhanced, and this is a much more recently discovered version of Raman spectroscopy, where if your molecules that are doing the vibrating are very close to a noble metal nanostructured surface, you actually get a huge surface enhancement, like a millionfold fold or almost a billion fold. And so suddenly you've actually got pretty nice signals if you're trying to figure out qualities of molecules, as long as they're near those important surfaces.
Okay, so you're using nanotechnology then in this spectroscopy. We've covered Raman spectroscopy a number of occasions on this program, and I was just wondering, I guess you use an atomic force microscope, any dip-in lithography or anything like that?
Not in this particular work. You could certainly use techniques like that to either make or characterize nanostructures, and we do that sometimes. But to do the actual experiment that we're talking about here, where we're doing this vibrational spectroscopy in blood, in this case, it's literally just about having your nanostructured surface, and that can be a solid substrate or it can be floating nanoparticles, inside blood, and you just have to shine a laser in, make sure you hit the surface, and then you probe the molecules that are very close to that structure with the photons that make it back out of the blood on the other side.
All right, now you've really got to tell us how this is useful. I mean, what is it going to tell you, and what are the applications? How do you use it?
Yeah, so one of the amazing things about Raman spectroscopy is that you really get a vibrational fingerprint for every molecule.
Okay.
You can have two molecules that actually have the same molecular formula, but if they're different conformations, you can actually tell the difference using Raman. And so what that means is you can figure out exactly what's there, what's in the blood, simply by shining a laser on it. You don't need to add labels. Right, so that's a huge deal, not having a label-free method. And so the idea here is that you could simply have a sensor in blood and you could learn something about the biomolecules for perhaps that are flowing through the blood. Or you could imagine checking something like blood doping, right, if you were thinking about athletics. Or you, in the case that we're developing, this is actually meant specifically for warfighters. The idea being that if you have somebody out in the battlefield that is perhaps being exposed to biological agents, or perhaps have some kind of infection, that we actually might be able to detect the molecules that signal those things in the blood of the warfighter, kind of on site, without labels, without taking samples and sending them somewhere and then getting them back.
So this is going to be particularly interesting to the Defense Department and to the different service people that have fighters actually in the field. And this is going to detect contamination from, let's say, chemical warfare, or contamination from, nuclear, or other things like that, or biological, germ warfare, that sort of thing?
Correct. So actually, the work is funded by DARPA, which is a defense agency, and they've given us some specific targets to look at. So they're interested in the things you would expect, right? Anthrax exposure, for example, or ricin exposure. But they're also interested in the general health of the warfighter, and so we're also focused on detecting proteins or small molecules that signal bacterial infection or sepsis, for example. So it's both looking at things that aren't supposed to be in your blood and things that maybe are supposed to be in your blood, ideally at the same time. And because it's a label-free method, you can actually do that. You can detect lots of things in kind of a multiplex fashion.
All right, well, somebody exposed to ricin, they might be goners by the time you're able to analyze their blood. The same thing, you know, nuclear people, you know, nuclear maybe is a little longer or something like that, but how is this going to be useful?
Yeah, well, I mean, the most obvious case where you'd think it would be useful would be in the case of something like sepsis, right? So you have a warfighter who has some kind of infection, and there are a fair number of biomarkers kind of early on in sepsis that you could imagine looking for, so maybe you see that coming on. But I think there are some things, like, you're right, ricin would be a really hard situation. We can actually detect it below lethal limits, and so maybe you would see a low-level exposure for somebody before they have actual health effects. I think it kind of depends. I mean, DARPA's ideal goal is either that this is a device that a soldier can wear that would kind of constantly be checking their blood, so
really?
Like a small microfluidic device, perhaps.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Or eventually that it might even be particles that you could make kind of a nanoparticle tattoo, if you will, so that you could just have somebody walk by a detector and you could actually just kind of scan them, you know, kind of TSA style at the airport.
So this would be really ongoing health monitoring, and it won't do anything to cure any of these ailments that they might get in the field, but it will alert people that what the ailment is and identify it pretty promptly, and then and regular treatment can be introduced. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. I mean, we're working on the sensor side of this, but there are also teams interested within the same kind of program that are working on the therapeutic side of this. And so DARPA is certainly interested in something where you would detect and then, you know, scrub the blood, essentially. We're not on that side of the project, but certainly our sensing capability tells them what they could possibly be cleaning up. And you get at the point that this is, you know, interesting for soldiers and warfighters, but of course DARPA is well aware that when we make major scientific advances that are good for soldiers, that there are often really broad implications for the rest of the civilian public, right? There are lots of reasons you could think this would be useful within a clinic or, you know, kind of any point of care diagnostic. And so while we are developing the technology with the kind of DARPA mission in mind, it's certainly not limited to those particular agents.
So all of this could be available in the regular healthcare industry after you have it perfected and that sort of thing. How far away are you from being able to reliably have this method in place?
Well, I think we're a lot further along than we expected to be at this time. I think there are a lot of people who've been doing Raman spectroscopy for their whole careers that thought there was no way it would work in blood. Right, blood is a really complex medium. There's lots of stuff in there, and I think a lot of us predicted that you would get way too much scattering from red blood cells and protein. You'd never see what you were looking for. So first, we're excited that you can actually do surface enhanced Raman scattering in blood. That's great. And we can detect things, like I said, at physiologically relevant levels. That's also great. Have we done any of these measurements in people yet? No. One really interesting thing, though, is that there are certain pathways that have been cleared. If we come up with something really good, that DARPA has a great relationship with the FDA, and this is something that could possibly end up on what's known as the innovation pathway, which is something that maybe you would get something to market faster than the usual, you know, 10-plus years that it takes to get something approved. So I think if we come up with something really promising and DARPA decides to put their full weight behind it, you could actually see this a lot sooner than we would expect.
I know there's a lot of work have been going on for some time on artificial blood. Does any of that enter into any of your studies or things?
It hasn't yet, I would say. I don't know if it will or not. And actually, I should make sure that I'm clear that while this is work that's going on in my lab, it's actually a big collaboration. So it's my group working with the groups of Richard Van Dyne, Milan Mrsic, Chad Merkin at Northwestern University, Catherine Murphy at the University of Illinois. We've got several partners at Stanford Research Institute. And so when you're working on a problem this big, it certainly is not a, you know, one lab kind of thing to take on.
Well, yeah, but you're a featured speaker along with some of these other people at PittCon, and I know that when you go ahead and talk to these people, they're going to be riveted with the things that you have to say. What is it that you're hoping they'll take away? What do you want them to leave with? You know, what's the purpose then of your talk?
I think the purpose from a scientific perspective is that it is really possible to do very good analytical chemistry in complex media, right? Most people would think that blood would be a nightmare to work in, and we have been really surprised. I think a lot of techniques that you would count out, so far, they seem to be doing pretty well, and you can detect pretty low-level analytes, and that's great. That's partially because we have great detection technology, right? That's come a long way in the last couple of decades, but it's also because we've gotten very good at figuring out how to process the data, doing things like chemometric analysis so that you can pick out signatures for things that maybe you wouldn't see the minute you looked at a spectrum. So I think that's the big scientific thing. Don't be scared to try doing these label-free methods in complex media. It doesn't just have to be blood, right? It could be any environmental matrix or anything else you could think of. As far as kind of a big picture general public message, I think that it's important for the general public to know that scientists are thinking about real practical problems, that we aren't, you know, in our labs just, you know, searching out answers to these very esoteric specific questions, that we are trying to figure out how to exploit all of the basic science advances to benefit the general public.
Yeah, that you're working hard all the time and doing things that we hardly even notice until it comes time that we are going to need them. And people are saying that the world is going to pieces. It really isn't, because there's so many new advances going on, and we're a whole lot better off medically and our life expectancy and everything else than what we were in the so-called good old days. Now, I've been fascinated with nanotechnology now for about 15, 20 years. And but how did you get into the study of nanotechnology?
I started studying nanoscience when I was a graduate student. So I did my graduate work with Richard Van Dyne at Northwestern, one of my current collaborators on this project. And I just wanted to do surface spectroscopy, but you need a surface. And the surface that ended up being really interesting for these surface-enhancing properties I mentioned earlier were these noble metal nanostructured surfaces. And so we dug in deep and tried to figure out exactly what about the nanoscale properties made the surfaces so good at doing what they were doing, really digging into the size-dependent chemical and physical properties. And since then, actually, my interest in nanoscience has expanded a lot. So I am talking about this one topic at PitCon, but my group has a huge effort in the area of nanoparticle toxicology, for example, where we're trying to figure out if what's the best way to make nanoparticles so that they will be most beneficial and most safe for people and the environment. And we also have a significant program creating new drug delivery vehicles out of nanomaterials. So we work on mesopore silica platforms to do drug delivery and therapeutics. And so my group is kind of up to our eyeballs in nano stuff.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it, no doubt. Rick Smalley, led the team that discovered carbon 60, made the comment that the nanotechnology, there's both the wet science and the dry science. Obviously, you decided to go to the dry science, the wet science into things, being in medicine. But you had talked about one thing here just a minute ago that I wanted to bring back, and that's the toxicity of nanotechnology particles. We had the problem, a couple of years ago, of workers in China being contaminated in a nanotechnology lab. You probably remember that. What are the prospects of toxicity with nanotechnology?
Yeah, so I think that over recent years, the field of nanotoxicity has definitely grown. There are a lot more people working in it. There's a lot more people doing really careful work. So people that are actually connected between materials and biology and analytical sciences so that all the right controls are being done. And I think a lot of the early questionable results related to nanoparticle toxicity were actually the result of some missing controls. And so what are the prospects? So far in the field, there are no unique modes of toxicity for nanoparticles. And that's actually really important, because what that means is that all of our current ways of screening toxicity through the FDA, for example, or the EPA or NIOSH, are all, at least to the best of our knowledge so far, are going to catch whatever issue nanoparticles cause. So there aren't any unique modes of toxicity. And we're not convinced that that's a finished story. And in fact, my group has quite a lot of effort looking to see if there are unique modes emerging. At the same time, people are thinking really hard about what are the motifs in nanoparticle design that make them safe? And how do we make sure we're making nanoparticles that are breaking down into something that's toxic? And I think there is really a groundswell of effort in trying to make sure that from the design standpoint, we're thinking about how to create safe nanoparticles. And personally, my gut feeling is that it's all going to be in surface chemistry. It's all going to be in what you coat the particle in that determines how stable it's going to be. And everything is toxic at some concentration, right? You can drown in water. So it's never going to be completely non-toxic. But the question is, you know, is it worse than anything else out there? And so far, the answer seems to be no, actually.
Wow. So you say to make the nanoparticles safer, you're talking about coatings. But aren't nanoparticles themselves used in coatings?
Absolutely. And actually, I would say those are the nanoparticles that I personally would be least worried about. If you have nanoparticles embedded within polymers or within, you know, other materials, they're least likely to escape, honestly. And probably, usually they're made out of things that are not too much to worry about. The most common worry that you hear with nanoparticles are with things like carbon nanotubes, right? There are people who have tried to draw this analogy to asbestos toxicity, for example.
Really?
And there are some questions about whether specific, you know, feature sizes like carbon nanotubes are leading to unusual modes of toxicity. But in general, when you talk about things like coatings, it is going to be about how do they break down, right? So once these things are landfilled or something, what's going to happen to the coatings? Are the nanoparticles going to be released? If they get into groundwater, at what concentration are they going to be? At that concentration, are they toxic to anything in the food chain? And I would say that those types of studies, those really aggressive, really thorough studies, are starting to be done. But it tilt-degree nanoparticle assessments. And so I think we're really getting somewhere. And honestly, I think we're a little bit ahead. You know, there are plenty of products that contain nanoparticles, but it's not a ton yet. There aren't a lot of nanoparticles, engineered nanoparticles, being released into the environment. Of course, there are natural nanoparticles and anthropogenic nanoparticles. But I do think that it's not cart before the horse. It's not that we've put a bunch of products out, we're injecting these things into people all the time, and we don't know anything about them. We're definitely, I think, trying to figure out design rules for controlling nanoparticle toxicity in a responsible fashion.
Yeah, and you'd mentioned about carbon nanotubes. Of course, those would be, I guess, the dry science and used most in materials and that sort of thing. But is your team a part of this, studying what is going on with the curing of cancer using nanotechnology? Or is that, because you're working closely with it in blood, I would think that there must be some sort of crossover there, too.
There is crossover. My group is working on a specific, what we call nanotheranostic platform. It's just kind of, you know, silly code words for nanoparticles that have both a therapeutic and a diagnostic component to them. And in our case, what we're working on is something that could essentially act like a Trojan horse, so hide some kind of drug molecule to treat cancer that would usually be systemically toxic, so something you would not want to inject into a person directly. So essentially hide it in a particle, and then make the particle so that it's either preferentially led to those cancer sites, which may or may not work, depends on how you design the surface, or make them go throughout the body and then have a trigger, essentially, inside the particle so that you can pick a certain region of the body where you say, okay, particle, it's time to release that drug now, just within that tumor. And so, yeah, my group is definitely working on that. We actually just filed a patent on a new material, and we're working hard with people in magnetic resonance imaging and nanoparticle-based heating to try and create something that might be useful in the anti-cancer fight.
All right, Christy, I want you to put on your...
Well, we have to take a break from the phone for just a minute, and... we're going to have to break at the half hour, and we're going to be back with Christy Haynes in just a little bit. And I ask her for a prediction of the future, and you're going to enjoy that. Christy is really a pretty interesting person, of course, at the University of Minnesota. And, of course, she's going to be speaking at PITCON, the Pittsburgh conference that's going on at McCormick Place in Chicago, March 2 through 6. And registration before February 10th, you get a $150 discount, so I want to remind you of that. To know more about PITCON, just go to the web and go to pitcon.org. That's PITCON.org. The fascinating thing about Christy is she actually runs a crew called the Haynes Group, who focuses on the application of analytical chemistry in the fields of immunology and toxicology. Main interest is nanotoxicology. Of course, we've studied nanotechnology on this program for years, but nanotoxicology is an emerging field that investigates the biological and ecological impacts of engineered nanomaterials. And that is some of the stuff that she's been telling us about here on the program today. We're so glad to have her with us. And as I say, we're gonna say goodbye to her in the next half hour, and she's going to give us a prediction of the future. So right now, we've got to take a break, and we will be right back with more on PITCON, the conference that's going on at McCormick Place in Chicago on March 2 through 6. And a final word from Christy Haynes, master chemist at the University of Minnesota. Okay, as we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. Who in the Den of Strangers will we meet today?
Alexander Solzhenitsyn. The line separating good and evil passes not through states, nor between political parties either, but right through every human heart.